new big game projectile is a sign of a much larger ideology that took hold faster than technology should have spread. Thus his word, cult. The first wave of human arrival, barring Steve Holland's evidence of early bone smashers and Dennis Stanford's Salutrian incursion, is by West Coast around 16,000 years ago. The second was a later influx around Clovis time, when an ice-free corridor linked the far north to the rest of the New World. Growing in population, people mixed, connecting with each other, reaching a continental zenith at a pivotal moment in climatic history. While 16,000 to 14,000 years ago had been ideal for human arrival, plenty of water, the cold slipping away, permafrost leaving the ground, grasslands rich in megafauna, Clovis arose when the good became too much. Ice dams were bursting, shorelines disappearing. 13,000 years ago, a glacier dam broke in Montana and took out half of Washington State and some of Oregon and Idaho. Ebullient masses of mud and glacial silt carried off bloated mammoth carcasses and archipelagos of drowned horses, everything inundated but the highest buttes and mountains. One waterfall was 3.5 miles wide, water plunging 400 feet into a cavity carved suddenly from the earth. Large portions of landscape were erased, giant gravel bars laid across the Pacific Northwest, sculpted into ripples 20 feet tall. Both Clovis and stemmed artifacts have been found in the area, meaning that this flood would have been witnessed by human beings. If anyone survived it, they must have sought shelter, perhaps atop a basalt-capped butte in the middle of the flood, the rocks shuddering underfoot as everything turned into crashing debris as far as the eye could see. It wasn't just floods. In central Mexico, volcanoes were erupting, encasing mammoths and human artifacts in superheated igneous ash flows, giant corpses cooked and tumbled all over each other. A controversial comet impact may be in the mix too, with glass spherules sprayed around the northern hemisphere, molten silica found spattered against plant and animal remains. One hypothesis is that this atmospheric impact, which struck over North America but spread worldwide, changed the planet's climate for the next 1,000 years. Images in a carved stone pillar at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey show a catastrophic and long-remembered event, a swarm of fragments falling from the sky, possibly changing the planet's rotational axis. Star patterns recorded at the site pinpoint the event to around 13,000 years ago. As if Earth weren't taking enough of a cosmic smack, some stellar event left a blast of high-energy photons and possibly lethal UV radiation in marine cores and tree rings about 12,830 years ago. Either a core-collapse supernova nearby in the galaxy, an immense solar flare from our own sun, or remnants of a bolide impact to the atmosphere. These events, together with thousands of years of epic flooding, dramatic sea level rise, and the swift decline of charismatic megafauna, would have caught people's attention. Bradley believes that the appeal of Clovis was largely in reaction to all of this. People may have created what he calls an apocalypse culture, a way of standing tall in the face of enormous changes. He and his colleague, Michael Collins, who heads research at the Galt site in Texas, wrote, "When the societal stress became too much and there was cultural distortion, either a new system would be needed or the society would fail and disperse or become extinct." Clovis was the new system. Bradley and Collins see a new American order in flaked stone technology, perhaps the shadow of a larger set of invisible behaviors and symbols, a codified system they describe as being designed to bring order, purpose, and meaning to life in the new environment. Bradley jokingly calls this Mammoth Feast Destiny. Not entirely a joke, he used the term to describe a cultural transformation, a mode of proliferation. As if people were taking down megafauna as a way of making themselves feel larger, better able to face these huge chaotic events around them. Some scientists take his hypothesis seriously when considering the impact of environment on a culture, while others say it's drinking the Kool-Aid and that Clovis was just another technological complex. But it wasn't. This was something new and grandstanding, and it spread swiftly from sea to shining sea. Lava flows, dry arroyos, and the edges of sand dunes course through the basin of the Jornada del Muerto in southern New Mexico. White Sands lies just to the south in the bottom of Tularosa Basin, home of ancestral Lake Otero. The Jornada lies to the north, a big country, one circular horizon rumpled and broken with mountains nearly barren. In English, the name Jornada del Muerto means a day's journey for a dead man. In the summer of 1670, a Spanish party passing through the broad, arid expanse found the remains of a dead horse tied to a tree. Nearby were the bones, hair, and clothing of a man. The name stuck. Mountainous escarpments stand apart from each other in the distance. Gaps open between them, gun sights on the horizon. Near one of these gaps, which looks toward a once glimmering and now empty lake, archaeologists have unearthed the largest, most deeply stratified Clovis site in the western United States. Known as Mockingbird Gap, this was a tool prep camp created when the Jornada del Muerto was a grassland, the head of every arroyo moist and trickling with springs, mammoths wandering the nearby lake edge. Mockingbird Gap is one of the gun sites on the southern end of the Jornada. The 35-acre site was occupied broadly and repeatedly, producing a rich assemblage of Clovis points and unfinished points, knives, gravers, end scrapers, side scrapers, flakes, cores, and a single mineral bead drilled through the middle, probably a piece of body ornamentation. This was a manufacturing station for the hunt, and over time, personal effects would have been lost, a hunter checking leather pouches, wondering where that red bead got off to. Bruce Huckle, an archaeologist from the University of New Mexico, co-led an early 2000 survey and excavation of Mockingbird Gap with Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona. In a 2006 investigation at Mockingbird Gap, at least a dozen individual sites were located that represent either discrete campsites of small social groups of Clovis that came together for short periods of time, or perhaps repeated occupations of the same site by a single group. This was an early American aggregation, unusual for Clovis people who tended to use fire pits only once, a quick layer of ash and charcoal, and they were gone. The land was gradually becoming known, people returning deliberately to places they'd been before. I put the question of population and movement to Doug Bamforth at the University of Colorado, who said, "One of the big stories of Native North America is a really tiny number of people ending up as a lot of people, and that takes time." Bamforth sees them covering large distances on foot, which is how Clovis spread so fast. The placement of other groups and of resources defined how they filled the spaces, setting routes across horizons to get the contact or minerals they needed. Bamforth said, "For the first few thousand years, hardly anybody was here. How do you live? How do you connect with other people? You get up and move." Paleolithic Americans carried rocks hundreds or thousands of miles, distances most of us only consider from planes or cars. Their mental map was on a continental scale. With the appearance of caches, people had to have some knowledge of where they were going and when they might be back. The continent could have been a single playing field, waves of mountains and plains from coast to coast traveled by a people, spreading their fluted points as far as they could reach. Studying the J.S. Clovis cache from the Oklahoma Panhandle, University of Oklahoma archaeologist Leland Bemmett wrote that the weapons in his survey had been used hard and put up dirty. Like J.S., many caches appear to have been used again and again, points broken and refashioned, signs of action in the field. Other finds consist of untarnished points, lined up and ready to go, many not yet knocked with the diagnostic flute, brand new and still in the box. The country was being seeded, hunting supplies made ready, some of them used, some not. Clovis was far from alone. Stemmed point users dominated the West Coast and the pluvial mountain and basin interior of the West. The different points mingled, but mostly stayed apart, as if representing two distinct continental cultures. People with different technologies clearly knew of each other. Stemmed points have turned up on the Gulf Coast of Texas, deep in Clovis territory, while a fluted Clovis point was found during the construction of a celebrity's home in the Capes of Malibu, California, a stemmed point stronghold. The two met in the middle, one arriving before the other. A pair of Great Basin archaeologists, Charlotte Beck and Charles Jones, have written that initial colonization of the Intermountain region most likely involved groups moving inland from the Pacific carrying non-Clovis technology, which was already in place by the time Clovis technology arrived. 8 miles from Mockingbird Gap, in the dry plain of the Jornada del Muerto, is the Trinity site. Another peak in the history of American weaponry. A sandy blast zone lies 340 feet across. At the center is an obelisk of black and mortared rock, with a plaque that reads, "Where the world's first nuclear device was exploded on July 16, 1945. The crater is still above radioactive baselines for healthy, prolonged human exposure, but plumes of saccatone grass and snakeweed have grown back, the Jornada covering its wound. The bomb used at the Trinity site was a wire-covered sphere, just big enough to crawl into if it weren't nearly solid, with a plutonium core set within an explosive shell. Its active components were built in a government lab at Los Alamos in the Jemez Mountains of northwest New Mexico during the final campaigns of World War II. Then they were brought down here for assembly and detonation. The explosion in the Jornada happened before dawn, when the stars were still out, clouds passing after a brief rain. The bomb is said to have been as bright as day, mountains miles away, completely lit by it. If the first people had seen the explosion from Mockingbird Gap, they would have shielded their eyes. What would they have thought, seeing this second sun rising? By Clovis age, with all they'd gone through, giant floods and regional extinction, continental shelves swallowed by the sea, they must have followed this mushroom cloud upward, necks craning, and wondered, now what? I remember Bruce Bradley describing the biggest Clovis point, 2 feet long, saying, "You can't use that for anything. The same might be said of nuclear weapons, too big to be truly functional, more a threat and a statement than a handy projectile." Half of the toolstones at the Mockingbird Gap Clovis site come from local green-black cherts and a reddish jasper. Other toolstone was brought down from northwest New Mexico, 250 miles away, sourced in the Chaska Mountains on the Arizona border and New Mexico's Zuni Mountains. This gives some idea of how far these people would travel. One piece of obsidian found at Mockingbird Gap was traced to the Jemez Mountains near Los Alamos. People gathered and processed stone in northwest New Mexico, brought their blades and preforms here to the Jornada, and worked on them further at camps that may have been launch sites for megafauna hunts in the marshes, arroyos, and lake edges. Pieces of the bomb used at the Trinity site were prepared in the same part of northwest New Mexico and were brought to a ranch on the Jornada, assembled there, and detonated at a conveniently remote location. If only an anecdote, the pattern of resource collection, assembly, and deployment are the same at the Trinity and Mockingbird Gap sites, 13,000 years apart. Picture scientists studying the Jornada in the distant future, believing that there'd never been a hiatus between the Ice Age and now. These bombing ranges would be an unbroken carpet of human history, an evolution of weaponry, where once we killed mammoths, then we killed everything. The scientific name Clovis comes from the town of Clovis, New Mexico, near Blackwater Draw in the eastern part of the state. It was the first Ice Age kill site in North America to be identified, what some scholars see as the first evidence of a distinctive people on the continent, with a codified way of making projectiles carried with tool kits of bone rods, napping instruments, and stone preforms ready to fashion into whatever the day required. The fact that the name came from New Mexico is happenstance. It could have come from any town in any state, Clovis having been found just about everywhere. In the late 1920s, the Dust Bowl scoured enough ground from the high plains that the desert around Blackwater Draw revealed the bones of megafauna, Colombian mammoth femurs like tree trunks mixed with the remains of giant bison and charismatically fluted weapons. At the time, this would have been the first scientific proof that early people in North America coincided with Ice Age megafauna, a fact previously disputed. The going theory was that humans appeared late, landing fully formed as Native Americans. Scientists were alerted to the presence of these bones and weapons in 1929 by a 19-year-old Eagle Scout named James Whiteman, who went by the nickname Ridgely. From the town of Clovis, where he lived, Ridgely began sending letters to museums and scientists, telling them he had found extinct elephant bones, which turned out to be mammoth bones, along with horse, camel, bison, and other extinct species. The young man also reported Indian warheads, his interpretation of fluted projectiles. He had some idea of what he was seeing in Blackwater Draw, having visited the same museum in Denver that I did several decades later. He'd also gone to the California Exposition, where the La Brea tar pits were opened to the public, displaying what were billed as the preserved bones and lifelike recreations of Ice Age megafauna. Finding these bones intermingled with human artifacts in the dust, Ridgely knew he had something. Rumors spread. Giant bones and weapons were sighted near Folsom, New Mexico, north of Clovis, almost at the Colorado border. The Eagle Scout did not relent. Aided by a prominent Clovis resident on the local Chamber of Commerce, he convinced archaeologists to investigate Blackwater Draw. By 1932, crews were digging in its banks, uncovering exactly what the Eagle Scout had described: megafauna and fluted points mixed together, a late Pleistocene free-for-all. New Mexico is not necessarily the place that the Clovis archaeological complex should have been named after. More appropriate would have been Florida or Maryland, where fluted points have been found in greater abundance. 90% of all documented fluted and Clovis-related points have been recorded east of the Mississippi, concentrated in Lower Appalachia, the Gulf Coast, and the Eastern Seaboard. This could, however, be an observer error. These are places of high contemporary populations, where artifacts are tilled up in farmers' fields, innumerable eyes scanning the ground. Modern population density, cultivated acreage, and intensity of archaeological research may have swayed the numbers. On the other hand, Western landscapes are often exposed and deflating, making it easier to find stone artifacts on the surface. A geologist digging for stratigraphy on the high plains of eastern Colorado told me he found a Clovis Age artifact under 27 feet of sediment. At the bottom of his trench, he uncovered the cut and burned shoulder bone of a camel, meaning that what was on the surface in the Ice Age is now under 27 feet of debris from rivers and wind. How much are we not seeing? This human-modified bone was found in what had been a shallow lake. The geologist gestured by rearing back his arm and throwing. He thought a camel had been cooked and eaten, and that some Clovis hunter sitting around idly afterward tossed the leftovers into the water. Clovis being named after the town has more to do with the persistence of an Eagle Scout and a Chamber of Commerce than with science. I find this especially fitting. Science is useful. It fills in the blanks with precision. But history is ultimately more about stories and the unfolding of human whims. Most of my family is from New Mexico. My stepmom and stepsister live in Roswell. My granddad died in a hotel in Albuquerque. My mom, the daughter of a telephone man, grew up in northern New Mexico, southern New Mexico, and the high desert in neighboring West Texas, where she was born. The surnames that make up my own history, Childs, Regal, Bierschwell, and York, come from this mostly dry and windy country, children, nobles, Bierschwellers, and tree people. My granddad, now buried in the Roswell Cemetery, used to drive me out onto the dry grass plains where it seemed the wind always blew. We were archaeologists in our own right. Every few miles, we'd see an abandoned house or a shed left empty for too many years, farmsteads gone under, turned to seed in the lesser dust bowls of the 20th century. If the door was off its hinges or blown open, we'd go in. I remember peaked roofs and wind-peeled door jams holding onto themselves against the sky. There was something eerie and enticing about these dwellings and their abandoned furniture, drawers that were empty and hard to pull out, wooden door frames and porch beams that still carried invisible traces of the original atomic tests. The open sky of Chavez County, where most of my family lived, inhaled weather. Storm clouds on the horizon, the smell of moisture, the sound of rattling grass, these are what I remember. My granddad and I were curious about the last skim of life, finding a date on a scrap of newspaper crammed into a hole, part of a black and white photograph, a lone wooden crutch in the corner. I learned that there was more than one now. In these abandoned places, I could hear a knife chopping on a woodblock, a chair scooting out from a table, and words lasting late into the night, hushes and whispers turned to dust. These are stories of my people, some of the memories that colonized this country. History books will show where we came from and how we spread, but they will not remember us, who we were, the reasons we did what we did. Why did they hunt the biggest animals on their landscape, when squirrels and rabbits have been shown to be 3 times more efficient as a source of calories? Notwithstanding Bruce Bradley's apocalypse hypothesis, it may have been a familiar human phenomenon rather than an end-of-the-world cult. When I visited the village of Savunga on St. Lawrence Island, I saw whale hunters and their aluminum skiffs dragged onto tundra. They hunt the largest animals in their world, bowhead whales, even as these cold waters and island breeding grounds offered all the nutrition they needed in small packages easier to acquire than whales. In 2017, a 16-year-old hunter from St. Lawrence Island is credited with landing a 57-foot bowhead for the community of Gamble. "My Yupik name is Agroaguk," the young man reported. "The girls on top of the beach saw a whale, and they thought it was two of them. It was this bowhead whale. We went out and chased it for maybe an hour and a half. The other boats could have gotten it, but they never got close enough to strike. It came up right in front of us, and I struck it." The same story might have been told by a young hunter in the late Pleistocene who delivered the first killing blow to a mammoth. A whale hunt, or mammoth hunt by extension, is about more than calories. It is a cultural feature, part of being a people. Around Savunga, I saw skeletons and butchered remains of Arctic bowhead whales on the beaches, where the Yupik community had, over decades, accumulated the remains of the largest animal they could hunt. Gary Haynes, an archaeologist at the University of Nevada in Reno, and an American mammoth expert, wrote, "While the vast majority of anthropologists would shudder at the thought of approaching 1,000-plus-kilogram animals armed only with hand-propelled weaponry, our hesitance cannot and should not be imposed on others. Recent forager-level hunters of elephant and whale are well aware of the potential risks involved in their predatory endeavors." Mammoth hunts would have been historic, each with its place in local legend, some of the tales retold for generations. The 16-year-old whale hunter will not soon be forgotten. Hunts would have marked important moments in time, a spear stabbed in the ground, saying here and now. Back in the Ice Age, the whales walked on land, armed with tusks and horns, each footfall shaking the ground. When indigenous hunters return with a whale, the village rallies, everyone comes out. In Barrow, Alaska, long-handled knives and cutting spades, known as cutting-in gear, are brought to the site. The whaling captain's wife and her helpers hurry to serve hot drinks and boiled maktek to the butchering party before they head home to start cooking and preparing more food. When the butchering is done, usually within 24 hours, a flag is raised over the house of the boat captain who took the whale, and an announcement goes across the VHF that the feast is beginning, everyone should come. In this way, the hunt becomes about much more than resources. It is a way of defining a people, keeping them together at the edge of the world. At Point Hope, Alaska, the captain who brought in a whale can be asked to hand over anything he owns. He is expected to fill the Thanksgiving and Christmas feast, giving everything away until his stores are empty, his family cooking for hundreds of people time and time again. Families might go broke, but the reward is a position in the community, the honor of taking a giant animal. That may be the reason people hunted megafauna in the first place. The whale skeletons I saw were sinking into the ground, the larger idly etched with names and dates with pocket knives or shot at for target practice. The biggest were dragged higher up from the water, where their massive, sun-bleached bones became fixtures, a place to stop for a picnic, a giant vertebra serving as a bench where you could sit and watch the sea. They were part of a cultural, human landscape. In New Mexico, We sat in the scrape and bluster of a windstorm, zinc-colored clouds whipping off the evaporated lake around us. We used our backs as shields and ate sausage, cheese, and mayonnaise, our bites gritty with gypsum. We'd left a camp in the dunes, and were walking the alkali flats along a high edge of ancestral Lake Otero. Storm clouds split into ghost fingers through the mountains and streamed over the dead lake. We weren't far from Pendejo Cave, a day or two's walk to this rock shelter in the side of a mesa that would have looked across the south end of the lake. Its name, Pendejo, is a bitter curse in Spanish. The cave is a crummy little space, not quite as nice as Paisley Caves, a rough shelter where you could cook or sleep if you had to. Archaeologists thought they'd found a 36,000-year-old human artifact here, as well as human skin prints in what had been damp sediment from the same age. Those dates, however, fell through, and scientists now say the oldest human presence at Pendejo appears in flakes and charcoal laid down about 13,000 years ago. This puts them in an early Clovis trajectory. A rough day in the field, giant cats outstalking the lake edge, hungry for anything, bad weather. Whatever drove them to this shelter kept them there long enough to leave rock chips and campfires. On the lake bed, there was no shelter. Jordan was nervous about coming out this far. We were seeing more impact craters and military ephemera, shrapnel and wind-blasted pieces of equipment, though we hadn't yet seen the fence marking the edge of the missile range. Jordan kept asking who the trip leader was, who was making the decisions. He looked at me as he spoke and said my name a number of times. I was trying to eat lunch and my eyeballs were sore. I told him we were all out here of our own volition, and it is perfectly legal to traverse the edge of a bombing range on public lands. Jordan said that was fine. He would do anything. He'd jump a fence on the range if necessary. But what, he asked, were we doing besides sightseeing on a dead lake? Beyond us was a dead zone, a scattered museum of war history, small parts of vehicles and sequential holes from long-ago strafing runs. Nick found a 50-caliber bullet. He turned it to show the butt, marking where the primer had been hit. The number 43 was imprinted at the edge. His eyes gleamed. It was made in 1943, he said. Meaning it was from another age, pre-atomic bomb, before depleted uranium was repurposed into tank-piercing projectiles. Of all of us, Nick was the best historian, having the strongest sense of what is at stake. In this bullet, he held a story from before the atomic age, before the world shifted. He knew what modern weapons meant. He'd pulled live bombs out of car trunks, puzzling over their many wires. A trail of blood led into the desert, a body shot through with shrapnel slumped against the steering wheel. He could smell the smoldering around him as he pondered booby traps within booby traps. This may be why I seek the older stories. I flee to them, crawling into their caves for sanctuary. But I know better. It was no easier 13,000 years ago. We live within the same ranges of tension, going as far as we can without snapping, regardless of the century or millennia. Bronze Age Ötzi was cut and wounded days before his death, and a flint arrowhead had been shot through his back into his shoulder. He probably bled to death where it cut an artery. 9,000-year-old Kennewick man in Washington State had a stone projectile embedded in his hip. The wound healed, bone groaned over the artifact. A human burial on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea revealed a skeleton pierced by 15 barbed points made of bone, one skewered clean through the spinal column from behind. These were no easy deaths. If it wasn't being eaten alive by wild animals, it was someone throwing a spear at you, or maybe many spears. Nick knew this better than any of us. I told the others to keep their eyes out for anything older than military artifacts, oddities sticking up from the playa, differently colored splotches of ground in a pattern. Mammoths wouldn't have left much, and chances of finding anything in the course of a day's ramble across emptiness seemed slim. The tracks would be round expressions, like pancakes or like badly cooked omelets. Ephemeral, washing away, they might be hardly more than discolorations raised an eighth of an inch from the ground. When we found a trackway, I didn't know what I was seeing or which way the mammoth was heading. One splotch, then two, a left-right pattern, some missing, some barely visible, seven prints in total. Jordan no longer cared how far out we were. We'd found something extraordinary. This had been a Colombian mammoth, the tracks circular, decayed, and toeless. There would be no scientific report on the find. We'd never be able to find these again or explain where they were. Compass bearings too vague on this expanse. No GPS to drop a waypoint. I walked alongside the tracks and the mammoth rose up from the ground, its body filled in by my mind's eye. It didn't seem to notice me. It was focused ahead, tusks swaying back and forth as it traveled. It had hair, with rough brownish or gray skin visible underneath, but it was not woolly like its northern cousins, with which this species bred along the northern margins of its territory. This mammoth was a deep continental animal. It may have never seen its smaller, woolly cousins. With proboscideans, you can't tell by a simple track which way it was heading without seeing its toes. Nor can you tell how fast it was moving, elephants having only one gait, no sprint or gallop. All I could tell is that a mammoth had been here. This mammoth had been here. The tracks would have connected to trails coming in from the Jornada and from the mesas to the south. If they were anything like modern elephants, mammoths reused old routes, pounding them deeply into the ground. You would have seen their trails coming and going from all directions to this lake. Mammoth tracks have also been found along a former lakeshore in Alberta, documented in fine enough detail that researchers have been able to determine the population dynamics. Known as Wally's Beach, the site indicates a declining mammoth population at the end of the Pleistocene. The Alberta tracks show the same herd demographics of African elephants that have been battered by poaching and drought, the adults more numerous than juveniles. In a healthy African herd, juveniles represent 60% of individuals. A declining herd is 30% juveniles. That is what is seen at Wally's Beach. By the end of the Ice Age, mammoths were on their way out. There have been at least 9 ice ages over the last 700,000 years. The mammoths were weakened each time one ended, but they survived and rebounded to face the next go-round. This time, they did not make it. For them, the last ice age was the end. After the 7th track, the prints washed away. The mammoth kept going, walking until it was only a space in the air. I felt as if I were the one retreating, the one left behind as the mammoth lumbered into nothing. Charlotte dropped to her knees about 20 feet from the tracks and pushed both hands firmly into the earth, giving an extra heave with her shoulders. She made 2 perfect handprints and scrawled the year of our arrival next to them, prints that would vanish in the next storm. This was our story. 1 geologic era later, mammoth hunters had found their quarry. A friend of mine built a full-sized Colombian mammoth out of driftwood and brush, erecting it at the edge of the small desert town of Bluff, Utah, where he lives. His name is Joe Paycheck, a local rock art specialist and a sculptor. A few years before building the thing, he announced that he'd seen what he thought might be mammoths on an ancient rock art panel. Along the San Juan River, not far outside of town, he saw pecked into sandstone figures that appear to be animals with tusks, trunks, humped shoulders, and rounded heads, as well as other large animals, possibly a cloven-hoofed muskox, an animal that once lived in this part of the Southwest. The figures are obviously old, a style unfamiliar to archaeologists among the hundreds of other images and symbols pecked into a cliffside above the river. Part of a palimpsest left over thousands of years. While some geologists argue that the rock face could not have held impressions for 13,000 years, archaeologists and rock art aficionados point out that the so-called mammoths are faded behind other images ascribed to early pre-ceramic cultures. This would make the mammoths the oldest petroglyphs on the rock face. Paycheck had more than the rock art to go on for building his mammoth. A small Clovis hunting site was found on a ridge not much farther out of town. The Lime Ridge site looks to have been a quick stopover for a hunting party in the Ice Age, a site for repairing and prepping gear while watching the circle of the horizon from a subtle high point. In a region of soaring rock towers called Valley of the Gods, This flat-topped ridge is high enough that you can see all around from it, yet not so high that it breaks the horizon. When Paycheck stood on it, he understood that Clovis hunters had chosen the location for the view, and also not to be seen. Along with smaller flakes and blades, Lime Ridge produced a single fluted point made of a ghostly pale chert with a small, heart-shaped mineral inclusion in its face. The tip of the point had broken off and was found nearby. With no earlier sites found in the region, this may have been a late establishment in the deepest continental interior, a country of standing red rocks where horses, mammoths, and muskox grazed in grass that rippled like sea waves in a wind few people had ever known. Lime Ridge looks down through a chain of gaps where mammoths or anything else could have been driven. This would have brought prey down to a shallow, brushy creek, what would have been a cottonwood bosque with ponds and marshes, now a dry, meandering wash at the foot of a dry, cliff-faced ridge. A mammoth leg bone was found in the next wash over, proof of their presence. In a canyon 70 miles from Bluff, a shaded alcove known as Bashan Cave, a Navajo word meaning big shit, has produced 255 cubic meters of mammoth dung with cannonball-sized boluses. Dung and mammoth bones found in the cave have provided 6 radiocarbon dates, ranging from 11,670 to 13,505 years old, which puts them within Clovis range. I spoke with a man named Kerry Hightower, who grew up running and culling wild horses in the canyon that leads up to Bashan Cave. He said that the canyon acted as a natural corral, and they used it to drive horses into a place where they could be gelded and have their tails cropped. Hightower said that in the back of this bouldery sandstone box, they corralled every ungulate that had been caught up together, not just the wild horses, but mule deer, bighorn sheep, sometimes pronghorn. He said, "And right above you is this cave full of mammoth dung." Not an academic expert, but a man who knows the land and how people pass across it, Hightower believes that people in the Ice Age were driving mammoths off the flanks of the nearby Henry Mountains, herding them into this canyon, much the way he and his family did with wild horses. This cave may have been their last stand, their last local refuge. Mammoth rock art, a small Clovis hunting camp nearby, and a cave blanketed with mammoth dung. That is a late Ice Age triad in southeast Utah. Other mammoth bones have been found in desert washes around the Four Corners, once a grassland among soaring red monuments. Paycheck collaborated with a local artist, J.R. Lancaster, and the two gathered materials from desert washes and built scaffolding, erecting a full-scale mammoth on a metal frame. The beast finally stood on all fours about 13 feet at the shoulder, bristling with wood, tusks made of 2 stripped cottonwood branches. On the winter solstice, the artists invited the surrounding community to an event where they burned the mammoth to the ground. The scene was festive and loud, heavy coats and warm hats on a chilly December eve, clear skies and stars out. Navajos and Utes came with drums and sang over the exhilarated gathering, some people dressed in battery-powered lights or masks, children running around, dogs trotting, wondering what all the excitement was about. This was the longest night of the year. Numerous rock art panels Paycheck studied in the area had winter solstice alignments, so he thought it only fitting, a way of getting through the dark and cold, remembering a flicker of light at the other end. The flicker would be a burning mammoth. A hush fell as an atlatl thrower reared back and hurled a flaming projectile from 30 feet away into the beast's left flank, just behind the shoulder. The shot was perfect. The same place puncture wounds and broken-off spear tips have been found in proboscideans from the Ice Age. The projectile might have flown between ribs and shoulder bones, piercing the heart or lungs. Flame quickly took hold as people roared. A second thrower came up, and another atlatl dart flew. It struck inches away from the first, and the crowd erupted into shouts and howls. Drums immediately picked up speed as the mammoth was engulfed. Held up by its own girth and a metal framework, the sculpture did not fall right away. After half an hour, the head finally sagged. 2 great arcs of cottonwood tusks slowly bowed toward the ground. The mammoth collapsed to its knees, then fell into a heap of glowing coals, stars showered with sparks. Native American oral traditions frequently refer to giant, dangerous animals that ruled the land. In one Navajo story, these beasts gruesomely tore people apart and ate them. One of the monsters was a giant bird that snatched people and carried them away, a story known from here to South America. In Navajo tradition, it flew them over Shiprock in northwest New Mexico and dropped them to their deaths on the pointed top of the rock, which was said to be made of spear points sticking upward. They were pierced and hung, bleeding among skeletons, food for monster birds' chicks. A pair of twin war gods came to kill all of these monsters in a story that can take years to tell. The slain bodies became part of the landscape. Monster bird was felled by a magic arrow, but its chicks were allowed to live, becoming eagle and owl in one telling, helpers to people rather than enemies. The monster slayer twins may have been Clovis, stories passed down through stories, hunters ridding the land of beasts too large and wild to live with. The magic arrow that killed Monster Bird could have been a point of a particular stone gathered from far away, reduced from both sides with bold strokes, and fluted up the middle. There were ways to kill mammoths. The record of bone damage from human projectiles suggests an attack from around the shoulder blades, trying to drive the spear between ribs into its vitals, which involved jumping, thrusting, throwing, or otherwise getting in close. Spear tips from Siberia and North America are found embedded in the upper ribs or spinal area of mammoths, shoulder bones pierced with holes from projectiles. Pressure upon pressure squeezed out the biggest animals, their final populations showing signs of disease, tuberculosis spreading among the giant bison, moving to other remaining big grazers. Colombian mammoths are thought to have endured longer in the well-watered hills, canyons, and mountain edges of the Southwest, while woolly mammoths survived in Wisconsin and points to the north. Mammoth and horse DNA found in soil samples along the banks of the Yukon River in central Alaska have been dated to between 10,500 and 7,500 years ago, indicating late surviving populations. Without other pressures, humans alone could have cleared the field of megafauna. It has been estimated that if humans culled 3% of the mammoth population every year, North America could have been mostly mammoth-free within a few centuries. Some mammoths in the far north escaped human encroachment, trapped on islands once part of the Bering Land Bridge. The last of these mammoths survived on St. Paul Island, largest of the Pribilofs, until 5,600 years ago. Wrangel Island, in the Chukchi Sea, off northwest Siberia, appears to have kept its mammoths the longest, the last of them gone 4,000 years ago. The St. Paul mammoths evolved rapidly downward until they were the size of Percheron horses, and they appear to have succumbed to a lack of fresh water as the seas rose and their island dwindled, possibly dying in the same climatic event. The Wrangel Island mammoths were closer to full size and dropped to a population of about 300. They died off in what has been called a genomic meltdown, mating within a closed loop, their hair losing its ability to insulate, proteins no longer adequately processed in the gut, glandular functions deteriorated, and sense of smell depleted. It would have been a rough and mangy demise. Mainland mammoths became extinct many thousands of years before these island survivors. Battered by disease and a changing climate, they were now facing a coast-to-coast colonization by humans. When the last of them vanished is uncertain, between 13,000 and 11,000 years ago, according to Bashan Cave in Utah and many other sites. Legends of hide and tusk would have finally faded from the upper Midwest and down here in the Southwest. This extinction event was the cry of a bullhorn, a piercing feedback loop. Native predators had to compete harder for prey, reduced in size and number, while former giant herbivores died off from overhunting by every predator, humans included, atop punishing climate changes. It might have been a quadruple, quintuple whammy, comet impact, radiation from a coincidentally timed supernova, a nitrogen collapse in ice age grasslands due to a shift in herbivore ecosystem dynamics. The presence of Sporomiella, a soil fungus that appears specifically with large grazer dung, drops off rapidly at the end of the ice age. The pattern of this disappearing fungus indicates that megafauna populations fell first in the east and later in the west, as if cash-bearing hunters were traveling farther across the Great Plains to find their prey, finishing off what pockets still hung on. Humans weren't the only invasive problem. Bison antiquus was also a factor, having come over the land bridge not long before people. They were non-natives, an arrival rarely good for home populations. Encroaching on the larger animals, spreading bovine tuberculosis, which has been detected in muskox, horses, and mammoths at the time, these bison may have been as much an extinction vector as we were. As the Clovis culture started up, Ice Age foragers and megafauna hunters were entering the crash of a wave. North America warming faster than it had in more than 10,000 years, big, cold-adapted animals moving to whatever relic ecosystems they could as refuge. Bison antiquus shrank, eventually down to modern bison in size, adapting faster than most other megafauna. When the big animals headed for refuges to wait out the coming interglacial, as they had done at the end of every ice age before this, they would have found people, armed and ready. The site near Snowmass, Colorado, was one of these refuges. Hundreds of thousands of years of mastodon and mammoth bones and tusks have turned up, right up to the first inkling of humans, a possible placement of 11 stones and possible butchering marks 40,000 years old. After that, no more remains are found. The megafauna did not return. Snowmass is 50 miles north of a hilltop outside of Gunnison, Colorado, where late Ice Age hunters had a regional gathering between 11 and 12,000 years ago, building a rock dwelling that overlooked the surrounding valleys where they lived year-round. They would have known their territory well. If a surviving mammoth herd plodded up the Roaring Fork Valley toward a refuge at Snowmass, following the picture of an alpine pond held in their atavistic memory, these hunters would have been there to greet them. Low clouds and a blustery afternoon rolled into White Sands. The day was shadowless. We'd left camp with day packs and were exploring north, finding fiberglass artifacts, trail markers from White Sands National Monument, a 275-square-mile park established in 1933. Trails, of course, were impossible to keep. They'd blow away within days or the hour. Instead, posts had been driven in, each within line of sight of the next. We weren't on the trail, however, drifting as we explored the northern reaches of the monument, where dunes sheet toward the Jornada. In the dunes, there is no reason to stay on one particular swell or another. It was like walking across the sea, our last day before we'd load up camp and head back to the vehicle. This is when Charlotte suggested a game. It would be like hide-and-seek, she said, but fiercer. I'd be a mammoth, maybe the last of them, and they'd be the hunters. I'd have a 4-minute head start. When I asked why me, Nick said, "What she's trying to say is that of all of us, you most resemble an old mammoth." They were a couple decades younger, Charlotte, a global summit guide, Nick, ex-military. Jordan, whose day job was welding, stands 6'4". Outrunning them would be impossible. When Charlotte said go, I was already loping away, skirting a dune edge out of sight. Keeping my head low, coat unzipped, I started to pull off my wool scarf as I glanced back. 4 minutes passed quickly. I saw their heads pop up, their raisin-shaped noggins obscured by blowing white sand. I sought low passes into bottomlands below dune crests. At first, they'd be jogging around, calling to each other. Half an hour passed, and they were beginning to see this was real. I'd taken off. As an old mammoth, I hadn't lived this long by being stupid. My line had escaped the bloodbaths of kill sites where mothers and juveniles of my kind had been harvested. We had learned the range of a thrown weapon. It doesn't take long to figure out which animals to stay the hell away from. I doubled back through one basin and another, hugging the flanks of steep dune slopes. If I knew these hunters, they would be scoping the crests, popping their heads up to look around. They were staying too close together, not covering enough ground. They thought I'd gone north when I'd gone south. Pale dunes blended into a cloudy sky, like looking into a bowl of oatmeal, which must have begun to weigh on their spirits. I put as much distance as I could between us, It took me an hour to lose them. No proboscidian kills have been found in White Sands or the Jornada, but between Blackwater Draw in New Mexico and sites excavated in southern Arizona, it was happening. The San Pedro River, flowing out of Mexico into southeast Arizona, is peppered with Clovis sites, with processed mammoths and bison, particularly the Lenner Mammoth Kill Site, where at least a dozen young mammoths have been found with projectiles, butchering tools, campfires, and the bones of bear, camel, tapir, bison, and horse. The pair of elephant-like gomphotheres recovered from the Fin del Mundo site in Sonora, Mexico, near the Sea of Cortez, were associated with fluted Clovis weaponry, marking the last recorded gomphotheres in the Americas, possibly hunted to extinction, at least given a shove over the edge. I didn't want to lose them entirely. Even a mammoth would have appreciated the sport, an old itch being scratched. I climbed onto a dune crest and waited till one spotted me. I wanted them to know I'd skunked them. When their small figures fixated on me, I could see bewilderment in their stillness. The person on the far right, about the size of a rice grain, was Nick, throwing up his arms, too far away to hear him shouting obscenities. We hadn't talked about how this was supposed to end. With my death, I supposed, or theirs. I had strong, eager, fervent people on my tail, and now they were frustrated. They started toward me, and I ducked away. Most of the post-Clovis finds around White Sands, small overshot and fluting flakes and pieces of projectiles from the later Folsom tradition, have been found at the far south end of the lake, south of Pendejo Cave below the Hueco Mountains. Their artifact distribution suggests a bit of a gathering, an area used with some frequency. While Mockingbird Gap, the Clovis site on the Jornada, was never returned to. These later Folsom hunters, at the other end of the lake, would have come into the dunes, tracking through these ghostly beach sands along a receding lake shore. If a mammoth were here, they would have at least seen its tracks leading along a damp beach, where they may have marveled that such a beast still existed. Hunters of both Folsom and Clovis age are considered communal hunters, working together in a variety of well-defined roles to take down shockingly large animals. If my friends didn't have a plan before, they did now. Spread into a fan, Jordan was on one side, Charlotte on the other, Nick in the middle. It didn't matter how far I ran, they would close in like a net. I tried to keep ahead of them, but I was tired. After 15 minutes of running, I slowed to a walk. I pulled out my journal and paused to write, waiting for my fate. My species had lived a good long while, that much I concluded. The first mammoths emerged in Africa about 5 million years ago and moved into Europe 2 million years later, spreading from there across Asia. About 1.5 million years ago, the giant steppe mammoth, Mammuthus trogontherii, one of the largest proboscideans of all time, crossed an early-bearing land bridge and entered this hemisphere, where it traveled south and evolved into the Colombian mammoth. I thought of myself, the mammoth, as the quintessential American, here long enough that I not only came from the ground, I was the ground. My kind would eventually be forged in the crucible of Clovis, a brave and terrible people. Now who were they? Folsom hunters, a new kind of technology, miniature Clovis. It seemed there were more of them all the time, guarding the passes and lake edges in an age when browse was becoming harder to find. The mammoth steppe was in the process of collapsing. Without big grazers, biotic turnover slowed and grasses turned to shrubs and tundra, no longer sequestering as much CO2, turning off one of the hemisphere's cooling engines. The ice age was shutting down. Mammoths weren't getting out alive, not this time. People would have known what was happening. It might have eventually dawned on them that a slice of their world was disappearing. In the dimming Pleistocene, they would have found big game farther and farther apart. If they saw the end of mammoths coming, would they have stopped killing them? When Nick found me on an open dune pan, it was somewhere between 11,000 and 13,000 years ago, and the wind was stinging our faces. The chill of December settled in. I looked up from my journal, and from half a football field away, we saw each other. I jammed the journal back into my day pack, pen into my pocket, turned, and ran. Nick cursed and broke into a sprint. He was a javelin, his momentum unbreakable. At the last second, I dodged right when he meant left, and he flailed. One flying arm snatched my day pack. I slipped out of its straps, and the pack flew free. As I ran off, he came to one knee, panting. He threw my pack out of the way and started up again. Jordan must have been watching, waiting. He sprang from behind a low dune. 30 yards away and coming straight for me, he roared, reaching out with orangutan arms. I could see his teeth. I dove away as he tumbled across the pan, landing on his knees. I ran away yelling, "Fucking bison hunters!" Charlotte wasn't around. Unbeknownst to us, she had drifted to the far side of the hunt. She'd taken out her contact lenses in the blowing grit and was near the monument trail with markers spiked into the sand. As she would later tell us, when she saw three figures walking over a high dune, she sneaked up below them, having pulled up one of the markers to use as a spear. Catching a mammoth and two human hunters by surprise, she was about to count serious coup. Charlotte planned to spring cat-like, a lone hunter, a feral creature. Shying her way up the side of a dune, it would be a dash, 100 feet or more, with the pointed end of the marker aimed at us. She'd throw it, and it would spear into the sand between us. She readied herself and jumped. The instant her head cleared the sand crest, she clambered backward and disappeared. It was not us. It was a family of three, a mother, father, and child bundled against the wind, out hiking for the day. Horrified, Charlotte shrank down the dune, narrowly unseen. At about the same time, I was out of energy. I was limping. Somewhere in the fray, I had pulled a muscle in my groin. A dune slope at my back was all I could do. I staggered with hands on my knees and looked for any other exit, but the hunters were already here. I turned with my ivory tusks, their great arcs towering over two men approaching with wild and wary eyes. They appeared drained, but undaunted. They knew what was about to happen. From 10 feet away, I locked eyes with both of them. No words, just bodies. They came in slowly. They had all the time they needed, breathing hard from the run as they drew to within arm's reach. I faked one way and another, one last chance to slip the trap. Nick dove and hit me in the knees, arms wrapped around my legs. Jordan was a quarter second behind him, his full weight plowing into my torso. I felt my tailbone hit the ground. The back of my skull made contact with sand. Breath slammed out of me. The hunters rolled off where they lay panting on the side of the dune. It was done. The mammoth was dead. Chapter 10. American Babylon. 12,800 to 11,800 years ago. When the front doors opened at Stuart Hall on the St. Cloud State University campus in central Minnesota, the ceiling heater kicked on and blew the cold back outside. It felt like stepping into an airlock. The upper Midwest had been bottoming out at 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, highs across the region not reaching above zero for weeks. NASA images of North America that January in 2014 looked like the heart of the Ice Age, the top half of the northern hemisphere blank white, Great Lakes mostly frozen. It was one of the coldest winters on record. The polar vortex, which sits on the top of the globe like a halo, had broken loose and hemorrhaged through an unstable jet stream. Hoops and gears of climate were wobbling and springing apart, reliable seasonal patterns breaking down as Arctic air fell across the northern hemisphere like a hood. I stamped off the snow as I came in. Night had fallen, classes were over, and the halls of the building were quiet. The last few nights I'd been sleeping outside, exploring late Ice Age conditions, a prolonged cold spell that came like a punch to the end of a geologic era, and I'd never been so cold in my life. As I walked down the hall, I left a leaden trail in the air from the shell of my coat. I pulled off my mitts, my hat, unzipping, letting in the warmth as I looked for numbers and signs on the walls. I was here to meet archaeologist Mark Muniz, who had been focusing on one island amid the hundreds of lakes in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota. The ground at his isolated site was covered with so many late Ice Age tools and pieces of debitage, stone flakes and debris, that he told me you couldn't walk without stepping on them. This was the Knife Lake Quarry Complex, a 12,000-year-old gathering and processing industry around exposures of a fine-grained Precambrian siltstone ranging in color from white to gray to chalkboard black. The rock comes off in tabular pieces, perfect for napping into tools and projectiles. Knife Lake siltstone comes solely from northeast Minnesota and was carried hundreds of miles to the south, one of the exotic tool stones commonly found in the upper Mississippi.